We need to continue talking about Amy Semple McPherson. For our purposes, Amy Semple McPherson is important because she interjects a very strong, sentimental, female element into evangelical Christianity in a very public and in a very sensational way. She preached on Jesus constantly. She hardly preached on anything else. This woman constantly preached on Jesus. And as you can imagine, she would probably preach most often on his what? What'd you think? Who knows? Who cares? His love. His love. His availability to us and his sacrifice on our behalf. She did not preach fire and brimstone sermons at all. Never, ever. Never mentioned hell. And her Jesus was totally non-controversial. She was surrounded in L.A. in the 20s and the 30s by hundreds, well, tens of thousands of rootless people, immigrants from Oklahoma, people who no one was from L.A. They were from somewhere else, a real urban frontier on the real geographical frontier. And she issued to these immigrants, these people from Oklahoma, a gentle invitation to come to find a secure home with her and Jesus in the Temple Angelus, the Temple of the Angels, or the City of the Angels. Like Bruce Barton, who was working at exactly the same time, she preached to Jesus who wanted Americans to feel good and to feel good about themselves. She herself identified with Jesus, especially with his suffering. As she began to be talked about, especially after the scandal, and as she began to have critics, and she did, she reminded her followers that Jesus also had suffered at the hands of his enemies, who had finally crucified him, just as she was being crucified in the press. But like the Nazarene, sister would always triumph in the end, she said. She created around herself what can only be called a cult of the personality. Her services attracted thousands of people, and they were broadcast over the radio to hundreds of thousands and then millions of people. And she began to be criticized for creating herself as the center of attention. But she continued to insist, I am not the center of attention, Jesus is. McPherson constantly used her femininity in her preaching. She presented herself and all women as being particularly vulnerable and in need of the protection that the loving Jesus offered to all people, especially to Jesus, to women. And her favorite story was of Mary Magdalene keeping vigil with Jesus in the tomb and then meeting him on Easter. She preached constantly on the scene of Easter between the distraught Magdalene and the gardener who is with Jesus on Easter morning. She asks him, where have you taken him? Can you take me to him? I want to be with him. Amy Semple McPherson has Mary Magdalene say, oh, I want him. Oh, I want him. I want him. Folks, that's sex language. Can you imagine a male preacher saying, oh, I want him? No, that's not going to happen. I want him. I want to hear his voice. I want to feel the touch of his hand on mine. No guy could say that. Her sermons, for their sentimentality and their lack of theological content, were inevitably criticized by liberal theologians. And she criticized them back. She said that it is the scoffers and scorners amongst liberal theologians who have taken away my Lord. And she said, in her criticism of liberal Christianity, that they have replaced the miracle-working, healing Christ of the Bible, the miracle-working, healing Christ of the Bible, with these things. And here is her litany of bad things. Moving pictures in the parish house, showing films at church. Chicken suppers, feeding people. Festivities, she says, having a good time at church. And preaching of psychology, community uplift, and social reform. You need to get that. Preaching of psychology, community uplift, and social reform. Now, those are the bad things. This is the litany of the bad things that the liberals have done to Jesus. But, folks, the litany is very interesting. Amy Semple McPherson is guilty of most of them herself, egregiously. She regularly showed slideshows of her travels to the Holy Land and gave lectures on them. She constantly had dinners in the temple and fed people. And her sermons were not only festivals, they were spectacles, at the center of which was herself. But she didn't do something she accused the liberals of. She did not preach community uplift and social reform. There were no social implications of the gospel other than the church taking care of itself in its own. And she most certainly did not preach psychology. And this will take us very neatly to our next point. Jesus and the culture of personality. Now, much of what I'm going to say right now comes straight from Prothero. Go right to the source. Evangelical conservatives like the scholarly Machen and the popular Amy Semple McPherson insisted that we stick to the Jesus of the Scriptures, the Jesus we find in the infallible Word, God the Word, that's at the basis of the fundamentalist movement. But liberals in the early 20th century were beginning to embrace all kinds of additional sources of earthly wisdom, other kinds of revelations, in their efforts to better understand God. Not just the scriptures of the Christian tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, but let's look at some people who are writing now or who have just written. For instance, Gandhi, who in the 20s is beginning to write in India about nonviolence. Karl Marx, socialism, communism. The great Eastern traditions of Hinduism and Buddhism. And most important, that new science, psychology, and its best-known practitioner, Sigmund Freud. Are any of you psych majors? Any psych majors? Your moment has come in Jesus. Rejoice. At the center of the psychological enterprise was the self. And what came in the early 20th century to be called, really for the first time, personality. Personality. That combination of things, characteristics, that makes us uniquely us and not somebody else. Prothero talks about an idea first put together by a great teacher at Rutgers called Warren Sussman. That need not detain us here. But this is actually Warren Sussman's idea. He says that in the late 19th, early 20th century, American culture moved from the culture of character to the culture of personality. Let me just recap, because you've already read it, right? Lie to me. Okay, in the 19th century, Sussman and Prothero, and now Dr. Miller says, Americans saw the self as the threat to social order. The self was the threat, was the most basic threat to social order. And the ego, selfishness within the personality, is the biggest obstacle to conversion and to spiritual growth. We had to be taught self-control and submission to authority by beating down the ego. We had to develop the virtues that become characterized as character. And these are the following. Patience. Forbearance. And empathy with and for others. In the early 20th century, these scholars say, that focus on character begins to shift to a culture of personality. We're entering a mass society, right? And in the 20s and 30s particularly, in that mass society, individuals began to worry about being themselves and their selves swallowed up in the larger mass. Losing your individuality in the community. The emphasis now shifts from self-control to self-observation, realization, beyond that, actualization, that's expression, an F one, self fulfillment. Culture, cultivating yourself to keep it from being swallowed up by the mass. Folks, herein begins the focus on the centrally located individual and self that is the most important component of a consumer culture. At the center of the consuming culture is the self-actualized, self-aware, self-aggrandizing self. Give me all of it now and at Walmart prices. This is the beginning of it, shifting from character to personality. The emphasis is now on self-assertion. A favorite definition of the time was personality is the quality of being someone. I wonder if that means anyone. It means someone as opposed to everyone, right? This is also part of the emergence of a focus more and more on manliness. We are no longer interested in self-control, but on the man who sways others. Self. Finding out about yourself. The implications are great for attitudes about Jesus. In the late 19th century, we break the taboos about writing about Jesus. We began to put him in his own culture. And we begin in the late 19th and increasingly then in the early 20th century to try to get into the mind of Jesus, to seek out his personality. Now remember that Henry Ward Beecher had already done a little bit of that in the 1870s in his The Life of Jesus. But in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, especially the 20s, books began to appear all over the place about Jesus' personality. Folks, this is unimaginable in the early 19th century. Jesus was over there as the Son of God. We don't go into his mind. There were books with titles, and don't try to write these down, because there's a bunch of them. Just get the impact. One was called, Who Then Is This? A Study of the Personality of Jesus. The Personality of Jesus. The Significance of the Personality of Christ for the Minister of Today. And this one's even more explicit. The Mental Condition and Career of Jesus Christ of Nazareth Examined in the Light of Modern Knowledge, Studies in the Inner Life of Jesus. The Psychology of Christ. And then finally in 1923, there was this tome. I have actually read every word in this book. I live to tell the tale. This is by G. Stanley Hall. Those of you who are psych majors better know who G. Stanley Hall is. One of the founders of modern American psychology. Child psychologist. He wrote in 23, Jesus the Christ in the Light of Psychology. I dare you to read this book. Almost 800 pages. It's almost impossible to read. Well, it is, but people read it all the time. And I'm, by the way, kind of a smart guy. But this is, do you have the PhD? Okay. It is a massive study of the way in which Jesus has been represented in art and literature. He studies Jesus' personality by writing about paintings and writings about Jesus. And he also has a detailed analysis of the life and ministry of Jesus. Got it? Now, here's the point. He focuses increasingly on Jesus' growing self-awareness. Jesus' life and ministry is an exercise in learning that he is Jesus. And when he finally learns that he is Jesus, he ceases to be Jesus. Guess who he becomes? The Christ. The Christ. G. Stanley Hall actually believes in the resurrected Lord. He is a real Christian, he would say. But, he said, the church and Christianity needs to get over this focus on the historical Jesus and all of the creeds that have grown up around him. Because all of that is simply steps in the ways, in the pilgrimage, in which Christians are beginning to understand who Jesus is. Jesus goes through this process of understanding who he is, and then we then learn, understand personally, by study, who he is. Jesus has led the way. Now, we must follow him. There had never been anything like it. And in discussing Jesus' growing self-awareness, he talks about virtually every one of the big names in early Western psychology, ending with Freud. All righty? William James. Jesus is figuring out who he is. Now, we have to figure out who Jesus is and what he means to us. What he means to us as individuals. And we can't be shackled by the creeds of the past. And don't even talk about fundamentalism. Got it? Are we clear about that? Okay. Are you sure? Yes. You can examine him as her question is, how can we get rid of Jesus of history and still examine his personality? He wouldn't say that, but you have to get away in believing that everything the Bible tells you about him is literally true. Because Jesus grows, and the church and Christians and writers and painters have grown in their awareness. We have to grow. Ready? Good enough. Going once? All right. Psychologist, your moment lasted 7 minutes. Your history. How about the Jews now? As I have said, liberal Christians reached out in all sorts of ways to all sorts of knowledge and insights into divinity. And in so doing, they went a long way in de-Christianizing Christianity. And as they did that, as they became more receptive to alternative views of divinity and earthly wisdom, those other traditions became more receptive, hello, to Christianity. Guess what? Non-Christian traditions responded by reaching out to Jesus and seeking ways to make our man their own. And this is particularly true in the 1920s and 30s in the United States in the more liberal wing of organized Judaism, which we call the Reform part of Judaism, with a capital R, please. One of the most remarkable things to be encountered in the study of Jesus in America is the number of books written on Jesus by Jews in the early half, the first half of the 20th century. Folks, there were virtually no important rabbi, liberal, reform rabbis who in the 20s and 30s didn't write something about Jesus. The process of Jews embracing Jesus, of course, is in one sense simply part of the process of assimilation to a Christian America. But these Jewish writers in the 20s and 30s wrote about Jesus with remarkable fidelity to their own tradition. And we need to emphasize this. Prothero talks about this extensively, so there is no need for Dr. Miller to do that right now. But I want to remind you, and you keep this in mind as you read Prothero and more in detail about this, that the Jewish rabbis were not trying to make Judaism more Christian. They were trying to make what? They were trying to make what? They were trying to make Christianity truer to its Jewish origins. This begins in 1925 with an address in Carnegie Hall by a man named Stephen S. Wise. At Christmas time, actually. He delivered a little address called A Jew's View of Jesus. In it, in very scholarly ways, he called for the conversion of Jesus to Judaism, for reclaiming Jesus' Jewishness. He reminded them of something that in the 20s, folks, Christians had to be reminded of. Jesus was born, raised, and died a Jew. Folks, they really did have to be reminded of that. Excuse me. Stephen Wise in 1925 very sharply distinguished between what he called the religion of Jesus and guess who else? The religion of Paul. Good for you. Dr. White has taught you folks something. The religion of Jesus was strongly informed by his Jewishness. But Paul's religion, Paul's Christianity, was defined by its strong opposition to, even demonization of, Jews and Judaism. Jews, with a great sigh, reminded Christians over and over again that the Romans had executed Jesus. And they said that throughout history, it was they, the Jews, who had been crucified by Christians. Jews would finally declare that Jesus was the greatest rabbi of all times. And they insisted that it was time for Christians to begin to behave like followers of the Jewish rabbi named Jesus. Said they, the history of Christianity is a sordid tale of the betrayal of Jesus by generations, centuries of his own followers. The 1920s and 30s saw a series of Jewish novels about Jesus, written by Jews, culminating in 1939 by a Jewish novelist called Sholem Ash, called The Nazarene. Ash's Jesus is a charismatic miracle worker who begins to believe, to understand, really, that he is the Messiah. Now you notice the difference between the verb believe and understand. If he comes to understand that he is Jesus, it means that Mr. Ash really believes he was Jesus, the Messiah, right? He didn't come to believe it, he came to understand it, that it was true. And on the cross, his messianic miracle worker dies a faithful Jewish martyr. And he recites on the cross the most sacred of the Hebrew scriptures, the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And the scene actually is echoes in a painting of 1943 by Marc Chagall, the great Israeli, Russian-Israeli Jewish painter. Chagall actually wrote or painted a series of crucifixions. And here is the yellow crucifixion. His Messiah, what does he have on his head? A phylactery. With the nimbus, he has a phylactery. Here is the Torah, the angel. Scenes from Russian Jewish life. All righty. Any questions? All righty. Hang in there. Let's talk about. Yes. 43, 1943. Jordan. Jordan wants to know the Jewish response. I'm going to say, read Prothero. The Christian response is in Prothero. Okay? What do you think it was? No, actually, for liberals, guess what? Let's talk about it. The liberal response. Let's talk about this. Maybe there's something to do this. Sure. Now, conservatives, you don't have to read Prothero, do you? Folks, they're just like us, you know. These, just because they're dead doesn't mean that they're different. They're humans, and you can figure them out mostly, okay? Let's do Jesus the Yogi. What a wonderful picture. Jesus the Yogi. About the same time that Ash wrote about Jesus the Rabbi, a man named Eugene T. Oliver painted a picture, mid-20s, called Christ the Yogi. This is in the Prothero book. His is a visual representation of the liberal reaching out to other sources of wisdom and knowledge. And, as in the case with the Jews, that other tradition reached back and made Jesus their own. The 1920s saw the culmination of American fascination with the East, with Oriental religion, especially with Hinduism and Buddhism. And this went back for a full century to Romanticism and to Transcendentalism. The most important name for our purposes in this is Ramakrishna, 1836 to 1886, an intensely religious young Indian man. And in Prothero, he tells about the various visions that Ramakrishna had. He had visions of Rama, of Krishna, of Shiva, of Kali, of Allah, get them all in, and of Jesus. One day, while Sri Ramakrishna was seated in the drawing room of another devotee's home, he saw a picture of the Madonna and child. Absorbed in contemplation of this picture, he saw it suddenly becoming living and effulgent. There's that word again. An ecstatic love for Christ. Notice it's not Jesus. Filled Sri Ramakrishna's heart. And a vision came to him of a Christian church in which devotees were burning incense and lighting candles before Jesus. It's been done, by the way. For 3 days, Sri Ramakrishna lived under the spell of this experience. On the fourth day, while he was walking in a grove at Dakshineswar, he saw a person of serene countenance approaching him with his gaze fixed on him. From the inner recesses of Sri Ramakrishna's heart came the realization, this is Jesus. Now he's Jesus, who poured out his heart's blood for the redemption of mankind. This is none other than Christ, the embodiment of love. There is a Jesus who actually did the act on earth. Got it? And then here is this vision, which is of the Christ, the embodiment of love. The Son of Man. Folks, he's become Jewish. That's Hebrew language. The Son of Man, Christ, then embraced Sri Ramakrishna's heart, and guess what? Entered into him. And Sri Ramakrishna went into Samadhi, the state of transcendental consciousness. Thus was Sri Ramakrishna convinced of Christ's divinity. Great quote, page 268. He said, as he adopted first the methods of Islam and then Christianity, I have found that that it is the same God toward whom all are directing their steps, I have found that it is the same God toward whom all are directing their steps, though along different paths. Thank you. Now, in 1893, there was in Chicago, as part of the World's Fair, a World Parliament of Religions. And to the World Parliament of Religions came, for the first time in the United States, representatives of the world's religions. And people got to see close up representatives of Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism. Hinduism was represented by Ramakrishna's chief lieutenant, Swami Vivekananda, a convert from Hinduism. Vivekananda stayed in the United States and became a missionary, the first Hindu missionary to the United States, with this strange blend of Christianity and Hinduism. Prothero calls the Gospel of Ramakrishna, as preached by Vivekananda, Jesus-friendly Hinduism. It's a form of Vedic or Vedantic Hinduism. It's based on the Vedas, the great epic poems. Vivekananda refers to Jesus as the divine incarnation, except that he is Christ, not Jesus. He is a fully enlightened God-man who understood his divinity at birth. No becoming, no self-realization here. He was, in Hindu terms, in Indian terms, in South Asian terms, an avatar, a divinity who descended to the earth. an avatar, a divinity who descended to the earth. Vivekananda has no use for the historical Jesus. For Hindus, like the Greeks, the soul is the essence of the person, not the body. Jesus in Vedic Hinduism is more a principle than a person, an eternal ideal rather than an historical reality. Vedantists, these Hindus in the United States, call for a Christianity without outdated rites and rituals that was inclusive of all people. It was time, they said, for Christianity to be a religion of Christ and of Christ alone. No rituals, no creeds, Christ alone.